Coming up on Philosophy Talk, language in action.
Hey, your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh?
How come we understand each other so well with so few words?
Holidays, Ned.
Could be taken on holiday. Swimming costumes, candid photography.
No, we don't have a camera.
Oh, still.
Sometimes you can say a lot with very few words.
Look, are you insinuating something?
Oh, no. Yes.
Words of nuance, words of skill, and words of romance are appeal. Words are stupid, words are fun. Words can put you on the run.
Where does the literal meaning of a word end and all of its subtle connotations begin?
Our guest is French social and cognitive scientist Dan Sperver.
Say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge.
Language in Action, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the beautiful Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And now you can check out the Best of Philosophy Talk, our podcast, anytime, anywhere.
You know, Ken, before we get started, I've got a question. I'm a little confused. We had that little conversation with the station manager, and he said they don't want sax and violins on the radio. But what's wrong with saxophones and violins? Why are they any worse on public radio than trumpets and guitars?
John, you misunderstood what he said. You misunderstood the words he used. It wasn't sax and violins. It was sex and violence. He doesn't want sex and violence on the radio.
Oh, never mind. But wait a minute. Violence is bad anywhere. I'm against violence. But what's wrong with sex on the radio? It sounds very uncomfortable, particularly on the little radios they have nowadays. But on the old radios you had when I was a kid, it wouldn't be so bad. And it seems to me it's not any of public radio's business where people have sex. I don't even think sex with a radio is against the law, at least not in California.
John, you misunderstood again. On doesn't mean on top of in this context. It means broadcast on.
Oh, I get it.
He doesn't want sex and violence broadcast on the radio.
I get it. What he said was that public radio doesn't want sex and violence broadcast. That seems clear enough. But now, why did he tell us that? Was he afraid that you would attack me during the show or that we would...
Stop right there. He wasn't suggesting that we would engage in violence or, heaven forbid, sex during the show. He had a completely different purpose in saying that. He was trying to alert us to what kinds of topics he wants to see on future shows. That's what he was talking about.
Gosh, I misunderstood him in almost every way possible.
Almost every way, but here's what you did. First, you misidentified the words. That's a matter of the phonology. Once you got that straightened out, you understood the meanings of all the individual words. That's semantics. You got that right. But some words like on are ambiguous, and you managed to pick out the wrong meaning for on. That's a matter of figuring out the speaker's intention, so you really didn't know what he was saying. And then finally, once you got all that straightened out, you were still wrong about why he was saying it, what he was saying, what he was trying to achieve. That's pragmatics, and that's what we're going to talk about today, pragmatics.
Well, you know, there is really a connection between pragmatics and sex, at least, if not violence. The sexual message is often carried in how someone says something rather than what they say. If Mae West says, "Why don't you come up and see me sometime?" you don't just think she's asking you to her office hours.
Good. Interesting you should mention Mae West, because she had quite a way with words that illustrates just what we're talking about. And our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out and channeled Mae West. She files this report.
Mae West's language had a subtext that's unforgettable.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
The mores of the 1920s and 30s forced her to use the double entendre that became her signature.
Don't forget, come up and see me sometime.
Double entendre was a popular vaudevillian comedic style.
That's Jill Watts, professor of history at California State University, San Marcos. She's the author of Mae West, an icon in black and white.
She really gains her voice and becomes popular after she begins to appropriate African-American performance styles. It goes beyond double entendre in the African-American community and becomes a double voice. Then also she borrowed it heavily from African-American blues performance, too, which is full of double entendre.
While a St. Louis woman comes down to New Orleans.
West got into trouble with the censors early in her career.
I think because she was such a controversial performer, avenues for her performance dry up, and so she writes her own plays. And the first play that she writes and produces is the play Sex. And it ran for a year until it was raided and shut down, and then she was placed on trial for staging an indecent production. And the thing that alarmed people from the beginning when it opened, just the name alone, Sex, was so blunt for the period of time, and she advertised the play with billboards that said Sex with Mae West.
She went to Hollywood in 1932 and ran right into the Hays Code. These production rules, designed to keep talkies clean, forced her to bury her sexually liberated message in her lines. Here's an exchange she wrote into her 1932 film, Night After Night.
Goodness, what beautiful diamond. Goodness had nothing to do with it, dearie.
How about this dialogue from the 1933 film, I'm No Angel?
You were wonderful tonight.
I'm always wonderful at night.
Our guy, what takes his time?
The censors went to great lengths to crack down on Mae West from 1934 on.
Initially, they scrutinized her scripts, and then they realized, and Mae West herself said this was the key, it wasn't what she said, but it was how she said it and how she looked when she said it. And so they stationed a man on the set to listen to her and watch what she's doing. Finally, they realized they've got to really crack down on her and scrutinize the lines, the dialogue, and view every clip.
But the censors didn't catch everything.
One of the films that was in 35, and this is after the censorship office is really up and running in a very efficient way, was the film Klondike Annie, and it was where Mae West masquerades as a missionary in order to get away from a murder charge. She, in that movie, was able to slip in the line.
Well, I'm caught between two evils. I generally like to take the one I never tried.
Mae West was going to play Mae West and write her parts the way she wanted to write them. And that was very important because Mae West is really all about language, if you think about it. She really can't play other people's lines.
West even pushed the limits when she did radio, getting banned from the airwaves for several years.
One of the things that all Hollywood stars did was promote their movies by going on the radio. And in the later 30s, in 1937, she was recruited to come on the Chase and Sanborn radio hour to appear with Edgar Bergen and appear in a skit called Adam and Eve. And this is what really demonstrates Mae West's use of language. She got the script, and it was a script they'd actually played before. She plays Eve opposite Don Ameche, who played Adam. It was how she delivered the script that got her into trouble. Here you had Mae West, the salacious Eve, offering Adam a bite of the apple, and the switchboard lit up.
Mae West became so tired of this scrutiny that she said she couldn't even order a cup of coffee without somebody looking for hidden meaning. Yet her films seem tame by today's standards.
She's not at all very sexual. There's very limited physical context. All of the beauty of this is it's all done through language. It's all what she says and how she says it, and it's this courting ritual that's done through words.
I'll never forget you.
No one ever does.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that really interesting piece on Mae West, the leader of hidden meaning in the visual arts, I guess. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Dan Sperber. He's a social and cognitive scientist from the Institut Jean Lecoq in Paris. He's a prolific author, but particularly relevant to our topic today. He's co-author with Deidre Wilson of a landmark book in pragmatics. It's called Relevance, Communication and Cognition. Dan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello. Nice to talk to you.
Hi, Dan. John Perry here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Now, up until you and Deidre published Relevance some time ago, a lot of us thought, well, here's the way language works. 90% of it is words. They have meanings. You put them together. The sentences have meanings. And that's what you say. Maybe you need a little intention guessing around the edges to take care of ambiguity and a few things like that. You kind of gave us a totally different picture. Language is 90% intention guessing with words helping out a little around the edges. Just tell us a little bit about those two pictures and why you like the second one best.
Well, I wouldn't put the same percentages, but you know, the Mae West example you gave is kind of misleading. It's beautiful. It's great. I enjoyed it. But it's misleading because it loses the banality of the implicit. I mean, everything we say has some implicit component. So you ask me, do you want some coffee? I answer, coffee keeps me awake. You know, it's nothing subtle about it. But you understand that I don't seem to be answering your question directly, but you understand that I'm saying that I don't want coffee and that I don't want coffee because it would keep me awake, and therefore probably I don't want to stay awake. And this happens all the time. And so indeed, if you look at utterances, the way we speak to one another, we encode only a kind of schematic, incomplete, gappy structure and bits of meaning, schema. And we manage with that to convey much richer meanings, which are, adapted to the particular circumstances in which we speak to each other. So yes, that's a quite different picture from the one you were first mentioning, where basically, the classical view is we communicate by encoding our thoughts in utterances, in sentences that have as a meaning what we mean to say.
But, somebody might think that, well, behind it all, fully worked out in our mind, is that fully explicit thing that we could have meant. You could have said to John, I don't want coffee because it keeps me awake. You could have said that, right? So there is a sentence that wouldn't encode that. And, we take these sort of shortcuts, and that's nice, but is there any deep point about that? I mean, we take these shortcuts, We could have taken a long cut. We don't because of convenience, but it doesn't show anything deep about the nature of language and communication.
I think there are several levels of depth involved here. So first you have the classical view, we code, we decode. Then you realize, where there are shortcuts, we can, provide some of our meaning without making it explicit by leaving it implicit and letting the audience infer it or guess it, as you put it earlier. Then the man who developed that, the philosopher Paul Grice, had the first important philosophical point to make. He was at that. I was told not to lecture, so I won't. but the point was, you need less meaning in the language, in the structure of the language, in the meaning of the words. If you can convey a lot of it implicitly. So you take the word "and." You might think that "and," like P and Q, like I went to the cinema and I went to bed. You can think of it as just saying that the both conjunct, the both proposition which are put together are both true, and that's the logical meaning. But, a number of so-called ordinary language philosophers pointed out, if there's a difference between saying, I took the medicine and I got ill, and or I got ill and I took the medicine.
Right.
The first thing is bad and the second thing is good. And so, and seems to mean also and then. In other cases, it's mean and therefore, and thereby, and so on. So do we have all these meanings for "and"? Well, if we can convey all this aspect of meaning implicitly, then we can have in the language just a very simple logical meaning for "and," and all the rest gets conveyed by, is implicit, is worked out by the audience. And so that's what Grice, who founded the field of pragmatics, was arguing. So that's already something that goes beyond saying, we could have said it explicitly, but we don't need to because we are shortcuts. Here's the idea that we can convey. We don't need to encode to have in our vocabulary all the meanings we want to convey.
I heard Grice give those lectures in about
1967,
something like that. Actually, it's 65 maybe when I was first at Cornell. Uh-huh. His example then was there's a difference between they got married and they had children, and they had children and they got married in 1967. That was very shocking to think about that. Totally lost on people today. But Grice had this this idea that we're constantly conveying more meaning than we say, and it's up to the speaker to infer what we're meaning. Yep. And he thought there were these maxims, helpfulness, and so forth and so on. He thought it was kind of a convention about language that you were supposed to be helpful. Now, do you and Deidre Wilson don't depend on these Gricean maxims, right? You have a more biological point of view.
Well, I think it's simpler. I mean, basically, we're entitled when we get into verbal exchanges, we talk to each other or read somebody's text, to have expectation about how the speaker is trying to communicate to us. Why are we entitled to have such expectation? Because, if I talk to you, I'm asking for your attention. And your attention is not given that cheaply. I mean, you'll pay attention to things which are relevant to you. So if I talk to you, I thereby imply that what I'm telling you is worth your attention, is relevant enough. And what Deirdre and I have tried to show is that this expectation of relevance is sufficient to work out all these implicit aspects of meaning, to start from this very simple schematic rendering of meaning that you find in what is linguistically encoded, and go well, well beyond it.
Dan, I'm gonna take that up, and I want to bore in on that a little bit after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is language and action. Our guest is Dan Sperber from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris.
We've been talking about how meaning, what philosophers call semantics, only carries us a little way towards understanding each other, and how figuring out intentions, what philosophers call pragmatics, has to come along and help out. In the next section, we'll see how these issues have inspired some big theories about human communication. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
What you say and what you mean when Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
That I'm full of shaving cream, be nice and clean. Shave every day and you'll always look keen.
Benny Bell with Paul Wynn on vocals and their classic Shaving Cream, a song that tells us a lot about language, although I'm not sure what. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic, language in action, pragmatics.
How about sharing some of your unusual communication experiences with us? Haven't you ever been completely understood, even though you actually said something that was totally incoherent? Or, conversely, haven't you been misunderstood or misunderstood others in interesting ways? Share your stories, and maybe you'll find them in some future pragmatics textbook written by one of your philosophers on the air.
Yeah, there you go. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Dan, our guest is Dan Sperber from the Jean Nicot Institute in Paris. Dan, you were talking earlier about the banality of this conveying what goes beyond the sort of encoded mm-hmm. meaning. Yeah. I want to bore in on this example of and a little bit. I mean, suppose I wanted to say, well, and is just like bank, right? I grant you that when I say it's better to get married and have children than to have children and get married. I grant you when I say that, I mean something like and then. There's a kind of temporal and. But mm-hmm. maybe and is like bank. It has multiple meanings. Like if you looked in the dictionary, you would find an and that means both conjuncts are true, one is true, and the other, and then the other becomes true, or something like that. Why isn't it like that? Why shouldn't I just multiply the kind of literal meanings of the words?
The guys call it modified Occam's razor, and the idea is that, and his motto was don't multiply senses beyond necessity.
Right.
So his point, his reason basically to develop pragmatics was to simplify the semantics. So a number of these complexities of meaning that you don't need to put in the semantics of a language, the meaning of words, in other terms, but which are somehow conveyed through inferences because of these expectations that hearers have, listeners have towards the speakers. And I think for reason of simplicity, this view is better than the one you're suggesting.
Okay, that seems like a powerful argument, but now I wonder, what do I, as the hearer, as the understander or interpreter of these utterances, have to know about that speaker to get out all this stuff? Do I have to, you said, I have these expectations about what he or she could be getting at or something like that. Do I have to be a mind reader? If it were all there explicitly encoded in the language, mm-hmm. right, then except for kind of resolving ambiguity, it would be easy. But if it's not there in the language, seems like I have to be a mind reader. Isn't that mysterious?
You are a mind reader. We're all mind readers. I mean, that's the whole point. We human beings, unlike other primates and animals, we are, you know, expert, virtuoso mind readers. And when we talk to each other, what we are giving to the others to read is a piece of our mind. When I'm talking to you, I want you to understand my meaning, not just the meaning of the words I'm using. These are the tools, the instrument for you to understand what I mean. And that's what's interesting. I mean, the meaning of the words in themselves, utterance in the, is not a source of knowledge, inspiration, and so on. It's because there's a speaker who is backing what she says with her authority, her beliefs, her intentions, and so on, speech is of interest to us. So mind reading, yes, we do it all the time. And verbal communication is the richest form of exploitation of this human ability to indeed attend to the mental states of others.
Well, let me ask a kind of a chicken and egg problem here, though. When you look at people's theories about the origin of language, there are people who think that, well, language is kind of this thing that must have come very early, and a lot of our intellectual development and our ability to think about other people's minds is due to the fact that we're social animals that have language. Now, it sounds like your picture would be more that we must have developed this ability to convey intentions and read intentions, and then language came along later as a way of helping. Would that be a correct inference from your point of view?
Indeed. I mean, there's this split among people who are trying to reflect about the origins of language, a kind of very difficult topic. And indeed, I believe that the human language has two extraordinary properties if you compare it to the codes of other animals. The one which is best known is much richer. I mean, both its richer vocabulary, syntactic structure, the recursivity, and so permits saying an infinite variety of things. So it's much, much richer without comparison, as compared to any other animal code. But there's another difference which is less often noted. It's defective as a code. I mean, a code to work well has to you have to have a one-one match between the signal and the message, human sentences of human languages are full of gaps and ambiguities. They still call for a lot of so if it were to work as a coding decoding system, it wouldn't work well. So if you want the story of the origin of both language and the ability to read minds, where language comes first, it would have to be a language very, very different from the one we're using. We are good at using this language. That type of language, which as a code is defective, is good for us because we can use these utterances, these words, as indications from which we can infer what speaker means. Otherwise, the ambiguity would make it useless.
I understand what you mean, but there are contexts in which we try, like the Dickens, to encode precisely in our language our meanings, like in mathematics, in a court of law, and we try to squeeze out as much of the pragmatic stuff as we possibly can. And you know, when philosophers started thinking about language hard at the beginning of the 20th century, that's the kind of the model of language they had in mind, right? As this pristine, logically precise calculus for thinking and reasoning. And you think that's just a total mistake.
Well, no, you're right, Cannon. But the thing is, and Grice's point was, you can have a language which is fairly pristine and with crisp meanings and so on, but what we convey by means of it goes well beyond this nice schematic structure. And, you know, to take an example of a court of law, yes, indeed, there they are trying to make everything explicit and also to make the context explicit by putting it, you know, in the record and so on. And they fail. I mean, the amount of argument you get about what was exactly meant, and you know, both in the past and if you look at precedents and so on, and during the events in the court itself, in spite of all this effort to get it really absolutely explicit, fails because there's always an implicit dimension. There's always a part of inference, and you just cannot get rid of it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about language in action, pragmatics, with Dan Sperber from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris. You can join us. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Esther in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Esther.
Hi, this is a thrilling subject. Not that they aren't all, but
okay.
I love this one especially.
Great, thank you, Esther.
And I thought of bringing up sort of a particular problem with pragmatics, which is that, of course, we do have people who have very little or no capacity to see emotional nuance in language. And, for instance, people who have Asperger's syndrome, very rational people.
Oh, Esther, this is a great question. People with Asperger's, with other forms of autism. Dan, I mean, those people seem not to understand. I mean, some people think that autism, for example, is an incapacity to understand other people's minds. Right.
And it is to some degree. It's not a yes or no matter.
Yeah, right.
The initial view was, oh, incapacity to read other people's minds.
Right.
Then there are degrees, and in particular, say, Asperger's are not that bad at it.
That's right.
They are different than, say, so-called normals. They clearly have a problem with understanding the mental states.
But here's my...
And since they are typically intelligent, they can explain well the problem. And the use of language shows, reflects right. the limits of our understanding of our mental state. So they're very good with language, but indeed, as your caller pointed out, there are nuances of emotions, poetic aspects of language, and so on that they typically miss.
Right. Do you have any examples at the tip of your tongue of the kind of things a person with autism or Asperger's might not get? That's unfair to you to ask you on the spot.
It is extremely unfair.
I know. Okay.
The typical example you get in the literature are examples of taking things in a strict little manner when it's totally inappropriate.
For example, if this is a made-up example, but if I said Juliet is the sun, this is a made-up example, but a person with a severe pragmatic incapacity would not get that it's a metaphor, right?
Exactly. The thing is just an absurdity.
Right.
You didn't make it up. I thought Shakespeare did.
Right. No, I meant that. I don't know if autistics would have a problem with that. We've got another caller on the line, Jeff in Hayward. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jeff. Oh, Bill in San Francisco is on the line. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'm calling in regard to things I've noticed when I listen to recordings of my own interviews that I do with people. Just like you're saying here, there's a huge gap between what perhaps I understood at the interview when I was in front of the person versus what it sounds like when I listen to it. And I'm wondering about the sort of non-verbal aspects of communication, gestures, facial expressions, and so on, which help us make meaning out of really quite meaningless sentences if we were to analyze them.
Oh, that's a good question. Dan, what do you think? Yes. Thanks for the call, Bill.
Yes, it's indeed a good point. I mean, we communicate by a variety of means. So typically in face-to-face communication, facial expression, bodily movements play a role. Even on the phone, tone of voice, things which go beyond encoding play an important role. But you can also communicate with written language or an email or reading books and so on. So clearly there are resources which are specific to language and which are incredibly rich. But I quite agree with your caller that in lots of real face-to-face communication, if you took away all the other means of communication, non-verbal, which are involved, then you would be left with something would be pretty hard to interpret.
I think one of the part of the power of this point of view that you and Deirdre Wilson and Paul Grice and others have put forward is it helps us understand the difference in different kinds of modes of communication. That is, if you think that the job of words is to kind of supplement what else is already there to help mm-hmm. us with this mind reading, then the situation in face-to-face, the situation in a phone call, mm-hmm. the situation in a letter, the situation in email are quite different. And we see that there are differences. If you call someone and they say, who is it? And you say, it's me. That's mm-hmm. kind of rude. I mean, you're kind of saying you ought to recognize my voice. Mm-hmm. Whereas in face-to-face communication, of course, it's completely different. So I think that pragmatics has a lot to tell us about the difference in these modes, and it might even be really important in developing technology that doesn't come across as rude or obnoxious. Mm-hmm.
Join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're talking about the pragmatics of language in action, with Dan Sperber from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris. Dan, I have a question for you. I'm going to go back to this mind reading and language thing, mm-hmm. though. I mean, you're a fluent speaker of English, but you're also a fluent speaker of French mm-hmm. and probably other languages as well. If you started speaking in French, I'd really struggle to understand you.
Yes.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I had 6 years of French, but it's a while ago. Mm-hmm. Now, so look, this mind reading can't get going on its own, right? I have the same access to your mind, which is, you know, absent language. I mean, independently of French or English, how does English give me more access to your mind than French does? It must mean there's something special about my relationship to English, to the language.
Well, English, of course, is the language of thought, and the other languages like French are just pale imitations. Well, wouldn't you agree with that, Dan?
Well, there was this French philosopher, I think it was Cordemois, who said that human beings think the language of thought is French, and that even the Latin who thought in French before they spoke in Latin.
Yeah, there you go.
But you say it's English, and given the political power of the United States, it must be true.
Yeah, I want to go back to the language. Yeah, it's a unique tool, and if I understand the language, I have unique access to your mind, right?
You have a much richer access. So the thing is, if you travel in a country where you don't know the language, you still manage to communicate about lots of things, but it's much more limited. So but if the general idea is we communicate not by encoding our thoughts, but by giving evidence of our thoughts, then what utterances are indefinitely rich, complex indication of what we think. They are the best piece of evidence you can use. The piece of evidence I can give of my thought with gestures, pointing, and so on, it's not bad, but it's quite limited. If I use utterances, then I can structure pieces of evidence as richly as I want, as exquisitely adjusted to my meaning. And indeed, I mean, the language allows us to see into each other's mind in way which would go well beyond what's possible without it. But for language to be able to play that role, you already have to have this ability to attend to the mental states of others, which we see appearing in infants well before they start speaking. So it's a basic human capacity which makes possible this very peculiar form of communication that is human linguistic communication.
So you might say that if you're a scientist and you're trying to write up your theory or experiments in a way that will be meaningful to people that are not only not in the same room with you, but maybe not even in the same generation as you and don't speak the same language, then you'll be forced to use language in a very explicit way that might more or less correspond to that old picture. But in the ordinary face-to-face communication, the kind of situation which language developed, it really is just a supplement to other ways of finding out, other ways of mind reading.
Yeah, I won't agree that it will correspond to the old picture. I mean, first, Shakespeare, whom we mentioned just a while ago, wrote a long time ago, was not talking to us, I had no idea. But we can read it, and it's all about implicit meanings. It's all about inferring complex suggestions, metaphorical connotations, and so on. It's true that when you are dealing with scientific work, as we said, with legal work, where you want your meaning to be as exactly understood as possible, you try to make it as explicit as possible. But there is no way to make, I would argue, and that's another philosophical theme, there is no way to be fully explicit. You always are after the speaker's meaning. If you're reading an old mathematician or a recent one, you still want to know what she meant.
Louisa in San Rafael's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Louisa.
Well, thank you. I had heard, I don't know if it's true, and that's why I'm asking you, I had heard that someone suggested juries should be blindfolded because it's more difficult to lie to someone if they can't see, whatever gyrations you're going through to try to convince them that they are telling the truth. Any comments on that?
No. Dan, you got a comment?
Well, just my comment is I hope I never lie, but if I were to lie, I would find it easier to do on the phone than face-to-face, so that may be going in the same direction. On the other hand, I would not recommend that jury be blindfolded. It seems the whole idea of the jury process.
So you don't think that's what they meant when they said justice is blind, and you should blindfold the jury?
Interesting suggestion. I don't know if that's what they meant.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing pragmatics, language in action, with Dan Sperber from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris.
We've been talking with Dan about his picture of language understanding as basically intention discovery rather than decoding. In the next segment, we're going to explore whether his insights tell us much about the nature of mind.
The nature of language, the nature of thought, and maybe the language of thought. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
That was Carl Perkins and Honey Don't. I'm John Barry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing pragmatics, language in action.
When you speak, do you just say what's on your mind, or do you make plans for your listener to figure out what information you intend to convey? And how do you go about interpreting others? Just read off their meaning from their words, or do you do a lot of intention discovery and detective work? call us and tell us what you think.
You can do so by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Dan Sperber from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris. Dan, I want to go back to language and thought just a little bit. So in the, you know, those old philosophers at the turn of the 20th century, some of them thought understanding language is the key to understanding the structure of thought, right? Thought kind of mirrored the structure of language. If language is just a kind of clue, a kind of hint, a bit of evidence, like a gesture or something, thought doesn't mirror the structure of a gesture. I mean, is there really any deep connection between language and thought that there isn't, say, between gestures and thoughts or grunts and thoughts?
Well, I think it's a deeper connection because clearly what you can do with language is articulate this piece of evidence I was suggesting of what you're thinking. So you're not encoding your thought, but you're showing a kind of map or a kind of blueprint of what your thoughts are, and that's better than what you can do with gesture. So it is indeed a source of insight about the structure of our thoughts. But it's, if the view I'm defending, if this pragmatic approach to linguistic communication is correct, then the view that understanding language and the meaning of words and the meaning of sentences tells you, gives you a general picture of what our thoughts are or can be, that picture is mistaken.
Yeah.
It's way too optimistic.
So when you say it's a language is like a blueprint to the thought, it's not really a complete blueprint, though. There are a lot of these gaps. It's not like a blueprint on the basis of which you could actually build the thing, right? But it's a blueprint on the basis of which you could kind of infer how the thing might be built or something like that.
Yeah, but actually when you have a real blueprint, that's, you know, a blueprint will not will allow you to build something with it if you know the material, if you know the gesture. You have to know a lot more to be able to take advantage of a blueprint. In the same way, you have to know a lot about people's mind, what's on people's mind, about the psychology, about the situation, about the context, and so on, to be able to take advantage of a blueprint which is provided.
Are we born knowing those things we have to know to be able to take advantage of those blueprints? Is that an acquired skill? Does it vary from culture to culture?
I think it's very much part of our basic equipment. That's what makes us human beings. And of course, it can be developed, declined, enhanced in various ways in different cultural contexts. Also, there are individual differences in one's people's interest in other people's mind varies. But basically, yes, it's a human feature that's there. It's part of what it means to be human. When you say is it innate, it doesn't have to appear on the day of birth. But clearly, there are illustrations of it from a 12-month-old infant. Exhibit an attention to the mental state of others that you would never find in any other species. Yes, it's present.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about language in action with Dan Sperber, 415-841-4134, and Jeff in Hayward's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jeff.
Hi, thank you. One of the most interesting books I ever read was frighteningly similar to your title today. It was called Language in Thought and Action, I think. I'm not totally sure. By S.I. Hayakawa, a very colorful character who later went on to become a senator in California.
Yes.
And wore a beanie.
Yes.
And quite a character. He talked about some basic things and some not so basic things, like the purposeful misuse of language by advertisers, who might say something like, our car is better than any car. And it's a nonsense statement. The advertisers don't say our car is better than any other car. They say our car is better than any car. Or they have monikers that are meaningless. They sound great. They evoke emotions and feelings and stuff. But as words, they're just totally ridiculous. Is moniker the right word? I'm not sure. But they're slogans. That's the word I'm looking
Jeff,
for.
Jeff, thanks
their
for
having slogans are always ridiculous. Things that really literally say nothing, but they evoke a lot.
So S.I. Hayakawa was a very interesting fellow. He was a professor at Cal State San Francisco, and he was influenced by, I think, Korzybski was his name. And these guys thought that language could be a really bad influence on thought. And they had zillions of examples. It all went under the phrase general semantics. I think they had a lot of good ideas, but they haven't been too influential in what philosophers and psychologists and cognitive scientists like Dan Sperber think of as semantics. Does this old Korzybski Hayakawa tradition have any influence on you, Dan?
It doesn't really, but the point that your caller was making is interesting. He was suggesting that some of it is a clean use of language, a proper use, where what you say is kind of nice and meaningful and possibly sincere, and another devious use of language where these things are kind of meaningless, but as he said, evoke. Well, first, when we talk to each other, we're always trying to influence one another. We may do that with an altruistic fashion or with more egoistic motives, but that's what engaging in verbal exchange is about. Second, typically, we express ourselves in a way which, if you really analyze it closely, you say, oh, you know, either it's it doesn't express a full meaning, or even it expresses something that doesn't make sense, as in the example it was given, if you take it literally. But nobody bothers to take things literally in this manner. We understand each other. That's the point.
But Dan, I think there's a deep point here, though, mm-hmm. that we can use pragmatics to mislead without...
Oh, yes.
George Bush, the British, mm-hmm. he said, the British government has learned that mm-hmm. something
yes.
about
yes.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Yes, indeed.
Right? When you say the British government, he didn't know, they say, I didn't say that. I mm-hmm. said the British government has learned, but look at the pragmatic implication of
sure.
has learned.
Yes.
If they have learned it, it's a fact, right?
Indeed.
I mean, so you imply that it's a fact without saying he's got weapons of mass destruction,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
I thought that was a masterful way of misleading, of distancing yourself from the claim while putting it forth as factual.
Well, we find objectionable in this case it was a lie, but we use that all this kind of way of expressing ourselves to be cautious. You know, I may want to convey something that's true, and you won't accept it on my authority. So I said, you know, John Perry has discovered that, and then you believe it,
right?
And I've been helpful because I've helped you.
But you didn't put your own authority behind it.
No, because
and if somebody challenges you,
my authority might not be sufficient where John's might be.
Ah, there. Now we're talking. Okay, we've got a couple of emails here that are pretty much mm-hmm. on this theme. The first short and sweet one from Roger in San Francisco says, isn't language used almost as much to hide intentions as to convey them? And the second from our old friend Pete in San Francisco talks about political speech. He says, your esteemed colleague Jeff Nunberg has unfascinating work mm-hmm. on the language of political speech, especially concerning mm-hmm. the GOP's uncanny ability to hammer the public with specific messages and take ownership of certain phrases like family values mm-hmm. and latte-sipping liberals. Can you or your guest comment on the particular power of language and its meaning in the political sphere? So there's some ideas for you to comment on, Dan.
Yes, well, you know, the notion that in speech we hide our intention as much as we reveal it, it's true, but it's not the same intention. Every time I speak, I reveal at least one intention, which is the one I want you to pick up, my meaning. My
mm-hmm.
meaning is an intention. It's a certain content that I want you to believe. Then my wanting you to believe something may be in order to cause you to vote for me or to adopt a certain attitude and so on. And that second intention may be less overt, or it may be even fully hidden. So there's always one layer of intention that's absolutely overt, and that's the characteristics of human verbal communication.
I think that's an extremely important point. I mean, if we have this picture that language is action, well, most actions mm-hmm. involve not just one intention, but a complex plan.
Yes.
Do this by doing this by doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's the same with language.
Absolutely, even more so.
Okay, but so this hidden intention, you think the only intentions that are ever hidden are kind of external intentions. There's a fancy word that we sometimes use, mm-hmm. perlocutionary intentions, right? The intentions that go beyond the sort of bare saying or something like that.
The perlocutionary intentions are typically not that hidden. I want you to, they may be hidden
yeah.
or not hidden. If I you know, utter an imperative, please pass me the salt, then my perlocutionary intention is that you should pass me the salt, and it's pretty clear and open. If I want to convince of you of something that's implicit in what I'm saying, that's my perlocutionary intention, and that's not overt. So, but again, we don't speak just some people speak just to hear their voice, but mostly we speak to try to influence others, and part of our influence is exerted by being open about it, and part of it is exerted by not being overt about it, letting people think that they are finding out themselves what we wanted them to find out. But again, there's a lot of the use of language is manipulative. What I would resist is the notion, oh, there are the good guys and the bad guys. Basically, we all use similar techniques. We may use them to good ends or to bad ends, to convince people of things we know are true or believe are true, or things we actually know are false, in order to perform actions that are in their interest or in our interest, and so on. So all that you'll find. But the way we do it, the methods which have been studied since the ancient Greek rhetorics, really, these methods are used by all speakers, whether well-intended or bad-intended,
right,
with good or bad intentions.
Well, Dan, on the moral equivalence of all speakers, at least qua speakers, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. This has been a really fascinating conversation. Unfortunately, we're just getting to some really other cool stuff, but thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Our guest has been Dan Sperber. He's a leading social and cognitive scientist from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris. He's a prolific author. Of particular relevance to our current discussion is the book he co-authored with Deidre Wilson, a landmark book in pragmatics, Relevance, Communication, and Cognition.
We also want to thank all the callers that we didn't get a chance to talk to. The buttons were really lit up this week, and the emailers that we didn't get a chance to get to. Thanks. We sometimes get good ideas from the email, even if we don't get around to listening to it. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, there was a flood of calls and emails right at the very end. Sorry we didn't get to you there, folks. So, John, what didn't you learn today?
What didn't I learn today? Well, first, I want to get back to that $5 word you used right at the end, perlocutionary, and tell our listeners that this really goes back to history of pragmatics, to J.L. Austin, who made the distinction between locutionary, illocutionary, and perlocutionary. Locutionary is what you say. Illocutionary is what you do kind of by convention in saying what you do. And perlocutionary is the further effects you have. And right here in the Bay Area, John Searle is the world's leading expert on speech acts. And Kent Bach over at San Francisco State is a leading pragmatist both on Gricean theory and speech act theory. So we have...
John Perry and Ken Taylor, don't
we? Yeah, we had John Perry and Ken Taylor. Boy, the Bay Area is a hotbed of pragmatics. So if anything goes misunderstood in the Bay Area, it's not for lack of philosophers.
Yeah, time. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about it. And, you know, we've just got a short time. But it's just, Dan's a fascinating guy. I'm not sure I totally believe relevance theory. I mean, I believe the core of it, but I actually think there's language is in some ways richer and gives us more guides to its completion and context than the relevance theorists.
Well, you know, there's this kind of dialectic that goes along in philosophy, so maybe Bertrand Russell and Frege were the thesis, and Dan Sperber and Deidre Wilson are the antithesis, and Ken Taylor is
the synthesis.
Give us the synthesis.
Anyway, this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Now, for the fastest language action this side of the Parthenon, we turn to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, these days the word rhetoric has a very negative connotation. It's what politicians speak instead of truth. Rhetoric is something that needs to be toned down. Rhetoric heats up. It's empty rhetoric. A rhetorical question is a question that doesn't need to be answered. Rhetoric means speech designed to persuade. It was at the heart of Greek and Roman culture, taught in schools, and when orators orated, they were judged in terms of how they employed their rhetorical tools. They didn't have printing presses. They didn't have radio or television. Speech was important. Rhetoric was to speech, in a way, what the FCC is to radio and television today. Rhetoric had rules defining what kind of speech was appropriate for which audience and what kind of argument. Rhetoric also identified an arsenal of language tools, including the simile, paradox, oxymoron, irony, and euphemism. In ancient Greece and Rome, speakers would be judged on their skill in using these tools, and points would be deducted for using tautology, bragging, bad grammar, avoiding the subject, swearing, affectation, among other things. We still judge speakers by their rhetoric today, obviously, though you don't always know why we object to or approve of a speech or speaker. Here's some of the figures of speech with which we used to be familiar. Epanados, for example. Repetition in the opposite order, as in fair is foul and foul is fair. Epistrophe. Repetition of ends. When I was a child, I speak as a child. Here's a good one, used widely today, though we no longer have a name for it. Preterideo. The inclusion of something by pretending to omit it. I'm not going to talk about my opponent's corrupt behavior. Related figure of speech is aporia, talking about what you can't talk about, as in, I can't tell you how many times I... Oh, there's isocolon, repetition of grammatical form. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. Prosthesis, adding letters to the beginning, as in bemoan or beweep. Diacopy, a favorite of Shakespeare's, repetition of a word to the word or words in between, as in villain, damned smiling villain. You probably all know synecdoche, making a part stand for the whole, as in all hat, no cattle, uneasy is the head that wears the crown. These figures of speech used to be familiar to audiences, but are now fairly specialized knowledge. And that's too bad. We might be lied to less if we knew not just what we were saying, but how we were saying it. My personal favorite is the zeugma, removing a verb from parallel clauses. Passion lends them power, time means. Or maybe my favorite is hypozeuxis, which means that you could have used a zeugma, but chose not to. As we all know, unless you know what you're doing, it is best to avoid zeugmas. I gotta go.
Thanks, Ian, for another great episode of the 60-Second Philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.